tools like Twitter and Facebook have let people share in near real time what they are doing. Now with a new generation of location-aware mobile devices, you can tell your friends or the entire world where you're doing it. Jeff Holden's company, Pelago, is one of many trying to come up with a killer application that blends location, images, text, and social networking to create a new kind of group awareness. Before starting Pelago, Jeff had a long career as a senior vice president of consumer websites for Amazon, and before that, the director of supply chain optimization systems. He'll be speaking at O'Reilly's Wear 2.0 conference on footstreams, clickstreams from the physical world. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Sure.
Pelago's first product is Whirl. Can you start by describing what Whirl is and what the experience to date has been?
Yeah, sure. So Whirl, actually, there's a little complexity there because we just launched Whirl V2.0, which is, you know, the product we're focused on. And Whirl V2.0 is a real-time storytelling product for people's daily lives.
When you say storytelling, I've seen a lot of people talk about storytelling with these new social network things. What concretely does that mean to you?
So the most important aspect of what we mean by that is the organization of the content as a story unit. So the unit of content inside Whirl is the story. A story for us is something that has a, you know, beginning and an end. It can have multiple kind of people involved in the story who can all share and contribute to a single story together, has a location associated with it, and then people put, you know, basically inject into those containers, the story containers, photos and text, and then, you know, once they're as they're doing that, that's actually being shared out to any number of friends that they choose, and those friends can then jump in and actually comment on the story, which then becomes part of the story as well. And so that's what we mean by it, is that we're focused on this. I think some people use that term generically. We're using it very specifically to refer to the core unit of content in Whirl.
From a practical standpoint, apart from people who are like chronic Twitterers and would just use it every moment of their life, what would you see a typical story being?
What we're seeing right now is a lot of families are using the product to share stories. And in fact, just this morning, Allison Sweeney from she's the host of The Biggest Loser, and she was on Days of Our Lives for years. She's like a really famous soap opera actress. She just started using Whirl today, and she visited the set of Days of Our Lives with her family, and so it's actually entitled Family Visits Days. And that story, we featured that story because it's such a cool. She did it publicly, and it's a really cute story about our kids and the visit into the, you know, with the cast of Days of Our Lives. So we're seeing a lot of that kind of thing. We're seeing people, sort of at a more general level are getting, doing kind of very, very funny things like Melissa Pierce, who's a really, very successful video blogger and just general blogger. She's done a number of very, very funny stories. She did one called Lonely Bear about this gummy bear lost in the world, the true sequence of photos and text updates. She told the story of Lonely Bear and kind of left it dangling. Is going to have a follow-up segment and is actually collaborating with people to build the next story. So people are using it in different ways, and it's really kind of unleashing a lot of creativity.
To some extent, pieces of this already exist, like Flickr has photo streams, and Twitter you can have kind of your real-time life laid out. What prevents this from just turning into this utterly fragmented space where everyone is in their own little gated community of the people who happen to use that service?
Well, first of all, the comparison to other services, I mean, the most subtle things can dramatically alter the way people use a product. And so people are perceiving Whirl appropriately, I think, very, very differently from, for example, Twitter and Facebook and other products that are social networking type products. But one of the things about our product in terms of this gated communities question is that we actually let people have complete control over the privacy level, the level at which they want to broadcast. And they can control that separately in real time and after the fact. And so we actually are fine with it if people want to, use it to talk to communicate just with trusted friends. There are enough people who are very excited about publishing to a very large audience that you can see a lot of content, public content appear around you in Whirl. So we haven't had any problem with that. In fact, we're surprised by the number of people who publish publicly. But there's also a lot of private publishing, and we think that's great. It's serving a purpose for people who then oftentimes come back to the website, and they use our website tools, which allow you to polish the story and edit it and change the flow and tell different sides of the story and publish it out again. And people, in some cases, people are very comfortable publishing after the fact to a much larger audience than they are in the moment. And so we provide both those capabilities. But we're basically, you know, we're starting from the customer and working from there, as opposed to trying to create some kind of public, everybody's got to be public with everything they do kind of sharing community.
Sure. I was looking at it from a slightly different perspective, which is if you look at like the one aspect of social networking, you know, you've got LinkedIn and you've got, God, I can't name them all, but you know, it's like 27 different services like that now. And it gets to be that people just get sick of it because there's so many of them.
Right.
I can see that happening again. You know, you've got Facebook, you've got Flickr, you've got, you know, again, you can name the 200 of them, and you may offer things that they don't, but people are going to kind of stick with their favorite things. It's going to be like the old days, and to some extent, this way it still is, where you got 9 different IM protocols, and everybody's on a couple
right.
of them.
Right. Well, luckily, I mean, the way we think about, you know, the different, you know, sort of, you know, anchors of the social networking world, Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and these guys, they're all, you know, we embrace them as opposed to trying to compete with them. So, you know, one of the things that you can do in Wurl, which a lot of people do, is you can publish your story out to your as your Facebook status, and you can publish your story out on Twitter as an update. And the way it works is it doesn't publish every single update you do as a separate post. It does it as one time you say, hey, this is the time right now when I'd like to have this thing appear as my status update on Facebook. So it embraces the Facebook community, and we take that so far that you can actually sign in with your Facebook credentials. You don't need to create an account in Wurl. And you know, so we very much embrace these existing ecosystems, and we see them as, you know, in many ways amplifying and augmenting what we do and vice versa, as opposed to, you know, trying to compete with them and steal people away from Twitter or steal people away from Facebook or from MySpace.
So you can almost see Wurl as a portal site.
Well, you know, we don't think of it that way. I mean, we think of it more as, you know, kind of a symbiotic relationship with these other sites. We're providing a particular set of capabilities. We wouldn't mind, for example, if people started using the story polishing tools from inside their Facebook experience. That would be fine with us. So to call it a portal, I think, would be not quite the right characterization.
The obvious Web 2.0 question here, what's your monetization model for this?
So we're not talking about it yet. But I can tell you, you know, some things it's not. It's not, you know, location-based coupons, you know, SMS bombs, you know, where you walk by the Dunkin' Donuts and you get a Dunkin' Donuts coupon. It's not location-based banner advertising. It's something that I don't think anyone's really talking about at all yet. And that's why we're not talking about it either, because we feel like, you know, it's pretty different. And so we're working on it actively, but nothing's locked, you know, nothing is running yet. There's no dollars coming from the strategy yet. And I want to just make sure we kind of bring it out and talk about it at the right time.
Since you brought it up, although you're saying you're not going to be doing any of those things, certainly a lot of these new location-based mobile services, you can kind of see as the slippery slope that leads to the holographic advertising popping up as you go down the sidewalk.
Right.
How are we going to keep the personalized experience under the control of the consumer?
Well, the basic way we're approaching that is that, you know, the consumer controls, you know, sort of when and where the data appears and is used. We're not entering into relationships, for example, we don't intend to, where we share personally identifiable information with third parties. And so, you know, from our perspective, the way we intend to use the data isn't annoying in that way. So, you know, so I can only go so far as to say what we're doing and how we're not contributing to that problem. But you know, there's no question that the, you know, sort of minority report world is something that people are actively working on, right? And it's not us, but there's no question people are trying to make that happen.
I have to ask a question because you obviously have experience as an iPhone app distributor.
Right.
You know, I went and checked out your app on the iTunes store, and like a lot of apps there's a lot of people who say they absolutely love it and gave it a 5, and then there's a lot of people who say they absolutely hate it and gave it a 1.
Right.
What's your experience been using the iPhone distribution channels?
Well, it's mixed. You know, it's the best game in town. So that's thing number one. And I think when you think that's the high order bit. So from our perspective, it's an incredible revolutionary improvement over the way the world used to be. So that's thing number one. But you know, when you get into the details of it, sort of once you're in the frame, you know, the discovery experience and in general the community kind of review process has got some obvious problems with it. If you look at our, you know, the reviews on our product, they're almost all, you know, 4 and 5 stars. There's a very, very tiny number of actual reviews with text in them that actually rate it below 4 stars. I think there's 1 3-star and like 5 1-stars. And then below that, and then besides that, what it is zillions of one-star ratings. They're just ratings. And one of the things that you can do, or what that happens with an iPhone, is when you uninstall an app, it asks you to rate it, and it defaults to one star. And so we know for a fact that we get tons of one-star ratings because I think people download, when we were featured, like when we first launched the app, Apple featured us, which is really a great, really nice thing for them to do. But the problem is kind of everybody, you know, there's no kind of qualification. Anybody just downloads it and checks it out or doesn't check it out, right? You just get all, you get very interesting kind of download and usage behavior from those, from that featured status. And I think the number of people, you know, run it and they see that you have to sign in and they just delete it. And so, you know, you get a one-star rating out of those experiences. So, you know, the stuff we look at closely is where we actually get, you know, textual feedback from people. And most people actually send that directly to us. And so we get tons and tons of feedback. You can just shake the phone inside our app at any time, and we capture the context, and you can send feedback that way. And that's where we get most of our feedback. And then we scrutinize any of the App Store feedback as well. But if I had to, you know, sort of say there's one big improvement that can be made, it would be making the community of reviewers and raters in the App Store non-anonymous, number one, because that always leads to a higher. I mean, I owned, you know, the review system for Amazon.com for many years, and, you know, it's one of the things about it that, you know, it's much, much weaker if it's anonymous. It just, you know, there's just kind of no one's putting any skin in the game with what they say. And I would also get, you know, sort of make sure that you don't have biases like these kind of, you know, one-star default undelete rating widgets. You know, make sure that if you have something like that, you have something on the other side too, so you get a really balanced score. And generally what we've seen is that, you know, talking to other app providers, when you're featured, if you don't have like a completely mainstream, you know, like a game or something, if it's something that, you know, fits more of a specific audience and demo, then you do get sort of deluged with one-star ratings. And when you come off the featured list, you start to see a balance out. So that's kind of probably more than you wanted to know, but that's just, no. You know, sort of one of the dynamics of the App Store experience. But like I said, best game in town.
Yep.
So, you know, I wouldn't trade it.
And luckily you're a free app, so you don't have to deal with the gotcha of refunds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's an interesting little space to deal with. But, you know, I think Apple's trying to evolve there. But yeah, I've been following all the fun with you get, you know, the 100% refund, you know, you give, but not Apple.
Before you started Pelgo, you did spend a lot of years at Amazon. The last few running the website experience, I had to say, just in comment, because you talked about the review system, I religiously use the review system, even if I'm not going to be buying something from Amazon.
Yay.
I'm a Prime member, so a lot of times I do. But
my team built Prime, too. I was very proud of that one, actually. I love that feature.
It definitely does change your buying experience. Like, I need tissue. I wonder what the price is on Prime.
I know, exactly. The right of first refusal.
Right. Amazon obviously knows some geographical information about their user base because they have to ship stuff to them.
Right.
Does Amazon leverage that at all into the product recommendation engine?
Let me think about that for a second. The product recommendation engine, do we use geolocation? I without giving anything away, I'll say it's not a primary component of the recommendation engine. But you can imagine that pretty much every piece of data is consumed for recommendations in Amazon. It's a very evolved recommendation system at this point.
One of the things that I've found amusing is my wife is in graduate school for psychology and also likes religious books. And I have to go in and we share an account and I have to go in and uncheck all of her stuff.
Right.
I start getting very bizarre recommendations.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the shared account thing was something that, you know, we struggled with for a long time. And we went down a path of, you know, trying to let people you know, tag things and then do recommendations by tag. I think that feature might still be there, but it never really took off. And so there's all these different ways we tried to sort of, you know, crack the code on that, but never really, you know, it's a hard problem.
Where do you see mobile location-based technology going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, you know, I don't know if you looked at our blog at all, but there's, you know, this is something that I've spoken a fair amount about in there in terms of like the, you know, sort of my kind of vision and the trends of, you know, where I think things are going. I think, you know, it sounds obvious now, but I think it's, you know, going to be obviously pervasive, and so you're going to see location aware in everything. And I think what that's going to lead to ultimately, I use this term, people are the media. I think what you're going to find is life gets completely digitized. And people, you know, there's going to be an adoption of that over time, but people will get to the point where there's a lot of comfort. And in fact, you know, so much value will be created by that people will, you know, not just get used to it, they'll actually love it. And so, you know, when I say digitized, I mean people's movements and what they're doing in their life will be very, very easily captured and shared. And and people will, you know, get a huge amount of value out of that. I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, when you, this is sort of just, you know, the kind of obvious intuition, but, you know, wouldn't it be amazing if, you know, if your parents, for example, could share literally an indelible record of all the things that they did, especially the key moments in their lives, you know, in terms of where they were, who they were with, what they were doing, and if that had just been captured as they lived their lives, they didn't have to go back and try to recreate that. You know, that's the sort of thing, that's what I think is going to happen, is that people living their lives are going to be the media, and then what we'll see from that, the second order effect, I think, is that you see people get inspired. That's one of the reasons we chose the story unit in Whirl, is because it's the source of inspiration. It's the thing that people go to, you know, for inspiration. And, you know, I've actually gotten feedback from people that are like, I'm actually doing more fun things now because I actually want to tell better stories through Whirl, which I'm like amazed it's happening this early. But that was certainly one of the key, you know, key things we wanted to achieve with the product. I mean, we, you know, the mission statement for the product was to increase the possibility of adventure and human connection in our daily lives. And, you know, and so I think that's what you see with the digitization of people's lives, is that inspiration goes up, and literally, I joke, but net adventurism goes up. People's lives become, you know, sort of less rutted and more, you know, varied and more interesting. And that's what my hope is. That's where I think you can create a huge amount of human value. And I think there's gonna be a lot of other ways that digitization of human life, you know, will lead to value. But that's kind of the track we're focused on.
I don't know if you saw, there's a gentleman who has one eye missing, who's putting a camcorder in the eye socket.
Oh my goodness! No, I didn't see that. That's amazing.
That's like when you see the science fiction with the news reporter who's like got the implanted thing. We've gotten there then.
Right. Well, you know, and that's just, you know, there's obviously a trend toward this, you know, this term people use, augmented reality. You know, that's when I talk about digitizing human life, I mean, it's bidirectional. It's not just capturing and pushing out what you're doing. It's also consuming information as you're living your life, and almost like a sixth sense. You know, the information is perfected in the sense that it comes to you in the right format at the right time, and so that you can actually consume it while you're actually actively, you know, doing something in your physical life. And that's I think where this is all going, or a very big piece of where it's all going.
I have to ask about not dark side, but the potential peril of this, which is as you get more and more people casually uploading kind of their experience into the collective cloud, and you get technologies like PhotoSynth and everything that can create aggregates out of that, you get into a situation where just people walking down the street are, in some sense, you know, to the extent that they're not already being surveilled by CCTV and all that other stuff, are going to just be part of this pervasive reality without necessarily opting in.
Well, yeah, there's certainly stuff like the CCTV is a great example. If you're in London, like your movements can be tracked kind of anywhere. And you know, there's definitely a trend in that direction. And my sense is that people won't be willing to let go of their privacy completely. And you know, there'll be some forces that are constantly chipping away at that. We obviously, with Whirl, we're not focused on trying to get people to give up their privacy. We want people to share in the most comfortable way that they're, you know, that they can. And so if you choose to share with one person, or you choose to totally make it private, that's your choice. We're giving the tools to be able to capture. And I think, you know, people do value privacy, and so you're going to see a social, you know, kind of reaction to, or like a social visceral reaction, community level, to giving up privacy in its entirety. And so I don't know how that'll play out. We're happy that our product is not pushing that particular envelope, but you know, there are, like you said, there are examples out there where, you know, there's just better surveillance technologies, and you know, just obviously devices can be tracked, and your mobile device can be tracked even if it's not through GPS. I mean, it can be tracked in other ways, and conversations are all digitized now, and so they can be stored. And you know, there are a lot of those kinds of trends in play. But my sense is, with regard to products, you know, when you're developing something that you want consumers to purchase or to use, you've got to be sensitive to the concerns about privacy. And so that's one area that we're incredibly focused, is making sure that we never violate someone's expectations there.
That's a very fair point. The only concern I have is, again, kind of this second derivative effect, which is, it's not that I was taking a picture of my wife. It's that, you know, the guy from America's Most Wanted is standing behind it. And maybe you did want to know that he was there, but, you know, maybe this is some guy who the state police want to pick up. And
right.
When TV shows film, they have to get waivers from everybody who happens to be walking through the background.
Right.
And there isn't that kind of effect in this new social media where there all this stuff is in there, and you could have facial recognition software, and then all of a sudden you could see someone mining Flickr or something and finding out every place a guy had been just by where he appeared in the background.
Right. No, that's a very real situation. And, you know, there's going to be, like I said, you sort of have to expect that there's going to be a social kind of reaction to it and that things will kind of reach equilibrium at some point. But, you know, one of the things that's true is that, you know, these technology waves, cameras appearing on every phone, there's absolutely nothing anyone can do about that. It's just, it's an unstoppable wave. And so, you know, there's you can find ways of living your life in such a way that, you try not to, be influenced by that or affected by that. But, it gets harder and harder and harder because technology is everywhere. It's pervasive and it is capturing these moments. And even if you're not, actively, as you said, the first order effect of you giving up your own privacy is different from you being captured in somebody else's, story or something, and being discoverable that way. So I think that's just a reality of the sort of wave of technology moving forward.
I guess people just have to start wearing those hats with mosquito netting on.
That's right, exactly. That's maybe that'll be the social reaction. Everyone will dress or they'll start wearing these. You've seen this technology that allows you to bend light, so you can literally have a cloak of invisibility. Maybe maybe those will sell well.
Now you're going to be speaking at Wear 2.0 about this idea you have called Footstreams.
Yes.
Can you give us a little preview of what the talk is going to deal with?
Yeah, well, what we want to do is I'll share the concept there and try to motivate people to understand the power of of Footstreams, which are literally it's the places people go in the real world. And so the sort of simple analogy is to a clickstream on the web. On the web, everything you do is a click, and this digital information is stored. Obviously, in the real world, there isn't any of that. And so the question is, what can you do with that data? And we can show from the early days of World 2.0 and from our World 1.0 learnings, how that data looks and how that, and what kinds of interesting things we can do with it. And one of the things you can do, as you can imagine, with my background at Amazon too, in the whole personalization space, you can analyze it as people who do this also do that. And so for the first time, really you'll be able to start to create value for people by opening up new kind of pathways for them in the physical world the way you can online with among 20 million books, for example. There are obviously an insane number of places and things to go and things to do, and we can start to expose things to you in a kind of push-oriented way based on your activities and the activities of other people in the community. That's a very powerful value add for people. So that's essentially the material I'm going to talk about.
I just got this flash of being in a restaurant and having this thing come up. It says 94% of the people who ate here went to St. John's emergency room for their food poisoning.
It might happen. And that would probably have an effect on the number of people who go there in the future.
We've been speaking to Jeff Holden, who is the founder and CEO of Pelago. He will be speaking at Wear 2.0 on Footstreams, clickstreams for the physical world. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome, James. Thanks for the call.